Our sponsor today is none other than our Patreon members. You folks are bringing swords and HEMA to listeners worldwide, so thank you. To support our work and receive exclusive benefits, visit patreon.com/swordwomen. Welcome to By the Sword, where we discuss the modern study of historical European martial arts, or HEMA, with instructors, experts, and martial artists from all over the world. In today's episode, we meet Aaron Lamontagne from Golden Triangle Fencing in Canada. We discuss swords, working with kids, and neurodiversity in martial arts. The episode was recorded on Instagram Live, 31 October 2021. Okay, so Aaron Lamontagne of Golden Triangle Fencing, welcome to the show.
Thank you very graciously for having me.
You're very welcome. And I take it that's Golden in is the region that you're living in. Is that where the name comes from?
No, actually. It comes from my deep love of The Legend of Zelda.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's where the logo comes from. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've even got the hearts from the Super Nintendo on my arm.
That's great. So that's where it comes from. So you're in Canada, as we've established. And so tell us how you got into HEMA, how you got into swords, how did it find you?
Oh boy, I've been into swords since I was, for as long as I can remember. I'm reasonably sure that my mom's watching right now, so she can, she probably remembers me taking anything sword-like, probably from, I think, maybe the age of two or three, and just running around the house swinging it around a bunch. I got into martial arts pretty young. I think I was about 7 or 8 when I first started doing Taekwondo. Didn't last super long, but I've always had an interest in it. I got into sport fencing in my ill-spent year in university, and really grew to enjoy épée. And then I spent a year in Winnipeg, and the first place that I did, I suppose, anything vaguely resembling HEMA was with the local SCA out of Winnipeg, and I think it was the Barony of Castle Rouge. I moved out to Vancouver about a year later, and eventually found a job working in a bar downtown, and I was just kind of tooling around before work one day. And I saw a sandwich board in front of the Academy Duello that said, "Learn to sword fight, first lesson free."
Yeah.
And thought within seconds, well, I'm going to go in and give them all my money. This is literally the coolest thing I can ever fathom doing. And then I went in and I trained for about 2 or 3 months, and then I ran out of money. And then my parents bought me some lessons for Christmas that year. And I trained for another 2 or 3 months, and then I ran out of money again.
God.
And through kind of coming back every now and then, eventually Devin and the other instructors took a shine to me. I wound up eventually linking up with Patricia Gonçalves, who was the head of the archery program at the time. She took me on as an apprentice, and I started learning how to teach archery, actually, before I learned how to teach any fencing.
All right.
Yeah, and then she started working for the CW as their archery tech for the very first season of Arrow. So I wound up taking over her position at the Academy's day camp, the night camp. And then I started working with kids, teaching them archery, mostly telling them that Orlando Bloom is a huge weenie because he didn't ever actually learn any archery for Lord of the Rings. then I started assisting with the sword lessons and the staff lessons, and then I just kind of started doing more and more until eventually I was leading birthday parties. I started leading lessons in the youth program. I eventually started heading the youth program after Roland Cooper went on to some of his other ventures. Then I was By the time I left last year, the only things that the academy's done that I don't know how to teach, I don't know how to pe teach people how to ride a horse. I don't know how to teach people stage combat, and I don't know how to teach people about like hand-to-hand striking, like the boxing or the Bartitsu program that did.
But you pretty much got the rest of it off
Yeah,
pat.
like anything. I've got a like the bio that I have on my site now. I've got a. I can teach a pretty good lesson on wrestling, dagger, sword in one or two hands, in or out of armor. I can do staves, spears, pole axes, and any companion pairings to that. Sword and dagger, sword and buckler, sword and shield. I can teach about 8 minutes of sword and cape before I run out of material, and I can even do a lesson on two so on a case of swords if I feel the need to.
And you can teach kids, so in my opinion, you're completely fearless.
Oh boy! Oh no, kids are easy. They're great. It was actually I'd never imagined that I'd grow to really. Oh, Kim's in the chat. I would have never imagined. Like I like to ask people like, what's something that 13-year-old you would find just mind-bending? And 13-year-old Aaron would find that not only do I love working with people, but that I really love working with children. He does say, this is a lie. You're an imposter. Go away, sir. I do not believe you. But I remember coming in to do some training one day at noon, and it was a I had opened the door, and like all the children were like trucking out to go, the ones that were going to go buy lunch were headed out, and all of them said, "Thank you, sir," as they walked by, and they looked like just perfect little warrior cherubs, and I was like, "This is cool. I like this," and that's kind of started me on the path.
That is cool. So, what though that's your backstory, how you got in. I mean, I think it sounds like drugs would have been cheaper.
I know, oh man, I keep telling people that I have an addiction to expensive hobbies. Like for the longest time, it was swords and sword play. Like over the last couple of years, I assembled a harness so that I could start getting into armored combat.
Wow.
And I did that about as budgetly as I could, and I still wound up spending just about 3 grand on it. And yeah, like it's not nothing. And now I've and I just last year when quarantine started, I was like, well, I got models, I may as well get back into Warhammer. Idiot child that I am. And now that I've stopped and said, Warhammer is kind of pricey. Maybe I should get into 3D printing and start doing like off-brand stuff. No, Aaron, no, you're doing it as wrong as you can. Stop. You have such a bright future ahead of you.
Oh my goodness. I talking about 3D printing. I went to an event recently and the organizer had a load of 3D printed muskets, like
Oh, that's
flintlocks.
rad.
Yeah, Nerf guns, 3D printed Nerf flintlocks. Yeah, I should have I should tell you that, and I shouldn't tell you where to go to find the patent.
It's
But yeah.
definitely not on. Not on. Again, drop that to me in DMs after. I might do that.
Oh, you twist
For
my
business
arm, I'm
purposes.
not gonna tell you. That's so much fun. So yeah, you got a wide variety of experience and interests. But what sources do you or did you study initially, or and what's your favorite?
I'm a student of the Academy Duello, so I grew up on 3 squares a day of Capoeira, because I got started even before longsword was a formal training program. But we get I got so, yeah I started with Capoeira, and once I got my blue cord and made
Straight
say
onto the
again
hard stuff.
yeah I get I it but in many ways like it wasn't, because I didn't have to do Capoeira. Like I remember the very first Vancouver International Swordplay Symposium. I did an actual Capoeira class with Guy Windsor, and he dead ass bullied us, because he was like, "Okay, let's go and do plate seven." And like all the Duello people were like, "What does that mean?" And he was like, "What the hell are you talking about?" Like inside engagement, your agente disengages to strike. You hit them in contratempo and seconda. It's like, oh yeah, we know how to do that. Good, do the thing. Okay, yes, sir. So like we like Devin and his staff like did their very best to really parse a lot of the logic down so that we could get like the theory and the logic from between the lines without having to like pound our heads against an obtuse translation for ages and ages. So I started with Capoferro, but I didn't really start engaging with the sources in any meaningful way, probably until I'd gotten my scholar rank and I started having to study Marazzo's first and second assaults. Mm-hmm. And that was the first source that I really fell in love with. I love Marazzo. I get a lot out of Capoferro. I really like Fiore because I think it's very pedagogically interesting. But Achilles, my boy. I love him.
Achilles.
I nearly wept with joy when Jerica put his translation out. It's one of my prized possessions right now. I love that big, beautiful brown hardcover book.
It's a good one. So, you know, you started on Capoferro, you've done some Fiore, but Marazzo is the one that won your heart.
Yes.
Was that with Sword and Buckler or Single Sword?
We started with Sword and Buckler, but as I took a look through it, I'm like, it interested me first just because there's such a broad variety of stuff to do. Big Buckler, Small Buckler, Targa, Rotella, Imbracciatura, mm-hmm. Cape, Dagger, and another sword. And that's just the sword things. Yeah, like people find it mind-bending when they're like, Cloak and Dagger. I'm like, yeah, there's a source for that. I have a guy that knows about that. Let me introduce him. And then pole arms and great swords. And a thing that occurred to me really recently that I've since like really that really resonates with me is that I feel like Marazzo is a very middle class fencing manual. Like Fiore wrote for rich people. Like it's like, okay, cool. So this is it. So you figured out how to do everything with a sword. Okay, great. Let's talk about putting on a full year's salary suit of armor and how to do all of that on a horse that requires its own damn farm. Sir, this is obtuse. There's a whole lot of resources in this. The only time Marazzo talks about a horse is how to deal with some jerk on a horse trying to hit you while you're on foot. And I love that.
Well, I mean, the middle class was created with the proliferation of the printing press, and Marazzo is a product of that, so it makes sense that it was, well, I'd say upper middle class twits to deal with idiots on horses attacking them, whatever.
We got like sons of modestly prosperous guild folk going. You're in university, you're about town, you're a gentleman, you're suddenly becoming a gentleman. My gosh, we should teach you how to like really play that role a whole lot more. Mm. Maybe I don't have much background in like academia or history. This is all a fairly surface understanding of it.
Yeah, I mean it's nice. Like I know, I think there's kind of I've mentioned this before in interviews with people, whether they're interviewing me or I'm interviewing them. When we talk about the sources, everyone's like, "What sources do you study?" And it's like, "Oh yeah, I study this." And like, not everyone has I find, in my experience, very few people can pick up a manual, read it, and go, "Oh yeah, I got it. Let's do it."
Yeah,
it's like filtering gold out of mud, or it's like hewing rock and trying to get to those little diamonds. You're in a mine trying to dig stuff out and work it and make it into whatever it is that you want to turn that material into. It isn't a straightforward process of just open a
book
and thing. It's a really long, continuous process, entire communities in order to do it. So it isn't just a case of pick a book up, read it, and know how to sword fight. It's so much more.
Yeah. I feel reasonably confident with my ability to like just pick it up, read it, and be able to parse it now. But that's like almost 13 years into my practice.
Yeah.
And like most of those were like under like tutelage of world class instructors and researchers who understood this probably better than I ever will. So that's. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite a journey to be able to actually even engage with this. And I can only, and if like myself, I feel pretty good about probably being able to parse most Italian sources, but if I had to, like, if you put a German book in front of me, like, I'm gonna go, oh God, what do I do? That's not true. I'm gonna text Jess Finley and say, what do I do? And she's gonna say, take a deep breath. I'll tell you what to do. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the majority of us are doing stuff that other people have worked on for us to then give to us so that we can do it. It's very rarely a case of someone is like working primarily from the sources themselves. It's usually at least a group effort or an student effort.
Well, it's neat to like kind of trace the lineage of understanding back too, because now it's a when I describe what I do to like a new group of children, I'll explain what a living lineage is. Usually in like the context of most of you, so a bunch of you have done karate. You probably have a sensei who had a sensei who had a sensei, and we both I'm pretty sure we both understand what a living like the living and reconstructed lineage is. Mm-hmm. It's neat to think, wow, I actually can kind of trace the lineage. I can trace the lineage of the children of my own teaching, and look at the lineage that I come from. I come from Devin. I come from his teachers in the SCA, and theirs before them, which is probably the teachers of Devin's teachers, I think, are pretty close to like the first generation of like modern HEMA as we know it from like.
Yeah, I think the lineage, the entire lineage, is alive right now. So that's how young it is.
Pretty wild.
Yeah, it's quite wild when you think about like the guilds went on for hundreds of years and stuff, and here we are, everyone's still alive, and they can text them when, hey, can you tell me? You can text.
Yeah. It's great.
So yeah, it's wild. I mean, talking about teach, like you're saying about the kids that you teach, I kind of touched on that. I find that the thought of that utterly terrifying. Tell us about working with kids, like how you got into it, and you know why you enjoy it, and what you think, you know, is the best way.
I got into it through teaching archery. The lady I'd been apprenticing under specifically brought me on because she wanted me to eventually take over her the youth teaching that she was doing at the academy. Mm. And I remember the first lesson I had to lead, I was shaking like a leaf through the whole thing. There was a bunch of 9-year-olds in front of me. I might have been like 23 or 24. And yeah, it's like 10 years ago. It was the dinosaurs walked the earth. Caesar was going through Gaul. It was a thing. Yeah, I taught that first lesson. I was nervous as hell through the whole thing. And at the end, I was like, I know that my own teachers, whenever kids would goof around, they'd give push-ups, and I don't think I get to do that. And my own teachers looked at me and said, what are you talking about? Of course you can give these kids push-ups. And I was like, oh. And then once I realized I had the authority specifically vested in me to say, you're being a jerk. Give me 10 push-ups. My job got infinitely easier. I'm like, oh man, this is awesome. This is bomb-proof. I suppose the broader idea of, there are boundaries that you, and it is your job to, and you are empowered to not only have them, but enforce them, made this whole thing functional to me. And I remembered a bar I was working at the time, a friend of mine said, hey, wife's had a really bad day. I want to take her out for a show. Can you come babysit our kid for a night? I was like, yeah, sure. It's like, we've told him all about you. He's so excited to meet somebody who loves swords. He's a big sword dweeb too. And I'm like, yeah, great. This is awesome. And I was driving over and I realized, oh shoot, I don't know if I can give a kid push-ups in his own home. I don't think I have that authority. So like, they totally ruined my reality. I couldn't be a math teacher. I don't think I could say, Tom, you're being a jerk. Give me 10 push-ups or else you don't get to learn the quadratic formula. Probably not.
Oh my God. So what was the solution? Was it not as bad as you expected it to
be? It wasn't actually as bad as I expected. The kid was an angel. It was such a pleasant night. I really enjoyed it.
So the whole teaching kids thing, I think Academy Duello is fairly unique in that it has children students. The vast majority of HEMA clubs teach adults. I know some have like, I mean, I teach, my policy when it comes to teaching is I tend to take from around the age of 15 up, and they have to have a parent with them because of our insurance policy. You know, you can't be unsupervised kind of thing if you're under 18.
Pretty easy to digest.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it stops people treating the school like a creche. And I think, you know, a lot of martial arts clubs are like that. It's just cheap childcare. You know, which is fair enough, you know. People have got lives and stuff. But, you know, I think a lot of the time, I don't know if it's because being female, but people have often said to me, are you going to teach kids? Are you going to teach kids? And I'm like, I don't really want to, but...
That's fair. Like,
I know that it's fair, but then what you're saying to me now is it's actually quite fun. I think I kind of steer away from it because I'm like, I don't want to be someone's childcare option. I want those to my class. And I have taught teenagers in a school before because the school I was working at were like, oh, come and teach these teenagers swords. And trying to teach 15-year-olds who don't want to do it something, even if it's swords, is not fun. It's not my idea of fun at all. So, you know, what advice do you have for, like, would-be teachers of minors, like, how to engage them and, like, how do you make... Because, like, your average adult HEMA classes can be pretty dry. You know, about sources and stuff. How do you go about it?
So... In many ways that I was kind of ignorant of sources work to my advantage in this way. Just like for a practical nuts and bolts like thing you could take with you today, kids work really, really well with games.
Yeah.
Like sparring games of any sort really, really work well with kids. Like I've had children that have done their very first lessons. And just going through basic cuts, how to stand, how to move. I'll give them a sword and a buckler and say, "Okay, your job is just hit the buckler." Then eventually, that turns into like an exchanging blows game where they take turns, and eventually, I start to say, and even if I haven't, I've usually only taught them like squallambrato, parry, riposte. And if they're real clever, I'll give them like yield, control the arm, pop him in the nose with a pommel. It's like the bread and butter first lesson. That's a really great way to do it. And eventually, you can like explain to the kids, okay, so this probably seems kind of stale. Bop, 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 bop. Now you can try to start adding in some angles to this. You can start kind of like walking around your partner while you do this, force them to change their posture. You can say, okay, so now instead of just this mechanical exchange, now we're going to gamify it a little bit. My job is when I'm attacking, I want to hit your shield. When you're receiving, don't let me hit your shield. But you can't just put your shield behind you. That's stale. You know, it has to stay at least in front of your chest.
Got you.
So kids will start to learn subtle withdrawing their buckler, really working their chests and their legs. They're just deriving how to deflect and parry, just as a logical consequence of this. Mm. And how do you keep from going just bonkers? You say, okay, and if you hit anything but the shield or the sword, you lose the game. I've done this with children. I've brought this to an Oktoberfest event when I let people that have been well and deep into a few steins of beer try it out. I mitigate that by having them maybe practice with me directly. But as long as I can kind of like observe what the class is doing, I suppose that's how I make it fun. That's how I engage them, and I feel good about doing that because I've got a good safety framework that I pass on to all the kids. I've been chewing on this a lot recently, and I'm currently working with a lot of homeschool kids and their parents, and kind of negotiating around the various sources of fundings and systems that they have, and I get a lot of. That have asked me recently, is this safe? And Yes, but the way there's the context in which it's practiced and understood is important. Like when most people ask, "Is this safe?" they're probably asking, "Are you using sharp swords and like making people like obliterate each other?" And no, but it's not the whole story because most people even see combat, like even more people see just combat sport or like violence in any sort of context, and they go, "I don't want the kids anywhere near that." Which isn't strictly unreasonable, but anything is unsafe if there's not if a few things aren't in play. I find that I can construct my safety materially by giving the kids foam swords, fencing masks, telling them to wear hockey gloves or lacrosse gloves, so that they don't get their fingers mashed if they get clipped. But material safety by itself doesn't do it all. I went down to an event in the States a couple years ago that I was happy enough to do harness specting in, but I didn't do any bloss in because I didn't trust the presence of the next two safeties. Like I can construct safety kind of technically or pedagogically. I can say instead of trying to mash somebody in the head, we can say or thrust them in the face and maybe treat the poor kid like a Pez dispenser. We can instead deliver a thrust to an outstretched palm, and your arm can absorb that force very readily. We can emphasize flow or control or just like mechanical stability over speed and force, so that the actions aren't okay, are more about like technical application than like violent intent. Yeah, you know, and I feel like most places will do these two ideas. You'll say, these are your equipment requirements. This is the rule set. The rule set, in the night camp that we taught, we did the material safety was everyone has to have a helmet, gloves, rigid knees and elbows. Boys and male-bodied folks should have to have a rigid groin protector to go at full speed. The technical aspect was everything below the knees and above the wrists, like hands and shins, those don't count as targets. So that even though they're armored, we've disincentivized them to force you to play to better targets and things that are a little safer, a little more easy, able to absorb this force.
Which is a very historical way of doing it as well.
Yes, but they get. But the thing, I suppose, like the third part, I think there's a cultural safety that you can build into your lessons, and more importantly, I think your club and your space, which is we are people in the year 2021 that pay jobs and hobbies and stuff to do, and we can't afford to have fingers broken, so we're gonna enter into all of these engagements with that full recognition in mind. And that's I think that's and I think that that like I don't have a perfect trust of the cultural safety in like broader HEMA. Like I think everyone's got a pretty good idea, a very good idea about what material safety looks like. I think there's a technical safety can maybe be kind of a mixed bag, but I think there's a I think cultural safety is catching up a little bit more.
Cultural safety is the subjective one, isn't it? Because
Yeah, and
you
that
have
means.
objectively strong gear tested, measurable safety.
Yeah.
But the interpersonal safety, the unwritten contract between you and I, sometimes it is a written contract if it's a tournament. You are
Yeah.
asked to sign a waiver and say you promise you won't do this. Whether people read that or not, I don't know. But it is very subjective. I think you're right. I think people are catching up with what is acceptable and what isn't.
Yeah. And the
It does vary from person to person, though.
yeah, person to person, club to club, instructor to instructor. I'm inclined to say that I have been very fortunate in my own experiences with with cultural safety because Duello gave me a background such that I have with like my friends, people that I am very close with and people that I trust, I will fence with gloves, with like gloves, nothing else. Like, because I get, but that's only because these are people that I know have the good sense to say, like a fendente that clears my guard and folds my hands. They know that that's going to continue and split my head. And I know that that's going to continue and split my head. And we both have that shared agreement and recognition that we don't have those other two safety, that we don't have like a really big like material safety in place. So we have to be very mindful of like technical, like the technical and cultural parts of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like I don't do it with everyone, but I think I have the framework to know when it's appropriate to do that, if that makes sense.
You know, I think it's important that people don't feel compelled to fight everyone.
Yeah, that's like it. That's a thing that I saw from a Guy Windsor post ages and ages ago that I've always, that I really deeply admired. He was teaching a group, I think in Seattle, a group of ladies that had asked him to, if he could build lessons on courage, or like if he could teach courage in some of his lessons. And he started with saying, okay, I think I can do that. So he started like on the first day by forcing all of his students to say, no, I don't want to do that to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave them like the lowest hanging fruit that he could manage. It's like, okay, let's do some full speed sparring with our bare hands, no masks, nothing. Who wants to do it? Who's brave? And all of them said, no, this is dumb. I don't want to do that. He's like, good. It's a brave thing to just tell an instructor, an authority figure, no, I'm not doing that.
I like that.
And he started finding subtler and subtler ways to ask that question for like the 3 days that he was doing that workshop. And by the end, he had asked a question, and just as a matter of course, someone said, "No, that doesn't sound safe. I'm not comfortable with that."
Mm.
And I think that's fantastic. I think that might be one of the best skills that you can give somebody in HEMA. And to the point of like the utility of a children's class, just being like a place where kids can run around and mash each other with swords. I think that's an ill-advised use of the forum. I think there is a lot of room for ethical instruction, and for the people that have the willingness and the space to engage with that, it is a very beautiful thing to be able to do that with kids.
Yeah,
I recall one day I was teaching a youth class, and a big part of the night camp is always we talk about virtue, and we talk about the 10 knightly virtues: nobility, obedience, mercy, justice, integrity, valor, charity, faith, courage, and humility. And we talk about what their definitions are, what did those things look like to knights that would have to practice them historically, what do they look like today. And we started bringing aspects of that into our youth program before I left the studio. And I can recall one day where we were sitting down and we were kind of talking about virtue in the circle. And one of my students, a Jewish boy with a darker skin, had talked about watching Jojo Rabbit with his parents the other night. And and there was this young lady, white girl, who had said, "Oh, me and my family watched it too. We had sat down and talked about it at the end, and we said, yeah, if it was starting to get really, really scary and pear shaped, for us today, we could probably just, you know, hop on a plane and fly away." And I remember saying, "Okay, full stop. This is important. We are going to talk about intersectionality for just a moment, children. We're going to talk about privilege." And I had like the perfect forum to just like totally hijack that conversation into that. And I like to imagine a pretty useful explanation, because I remember asking at one point, okay, who's heard the term privilege and thinks it's kind of silly, or that it's like a made up thing that that people you don't like say, and like a bunch of the boys put their hands up. I'm like, all right, let's dive into it. And and most of them left at it going, okay, yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm not a bad person. I just, it's just my life isn't easy. It's just not hard because of X, Y, and Z. I was like, yes, I got through to these kids. I got it. Yes, I feel so good about this. I think it was my first summer in night camp. I think I'd been doing it. It was maybe my third or fourth week. I was signing kids out at the end of the day, and a mom walked in and like grabbed me by my by the collar and said, "What have you done to my son?" And I was like 23, 24. I went ghost white. I went, "Excuse me?" And she's like, "What have you done to him? He's nice to his sister. He walks the dog. We only got to ask him twice to clean his room. What'd you do to him?" And I just kind of dumbly pointed to the big virtue poster we had up on the wall and said, "We taught him about obedience, miss. That's it." Yeah, it can be very transformative, and it can expose people not just to empathy, to curiosity, just as like a mechanical necessity of what you do. And if you construct your weapons very, very, if you construct your lessons very deliberately to that, they become ethical instruction. You can talk about in a very Fiore club, you'd talk to your kids about Fiore's four virtues on the seven sword page. What do we mean by audacity? What do we mean by fortitude? What do we mean by celerity? How do we practice them? Why are they useful? When are they not useful to us? What is the excess or what does the dearth of these things look like? Which is, and the kids are like, you'd probably be just shocked by how clever these kids are. Like, I ran just this last summer, I ran my very own day camp for the first time. I ran a LARP camp to teaching kids about sword fighting, archery, and making stuff for their LARP characters. And we had been sitting down talking, and I asked them about things history can inform your characters. You can start to study it. You can start to study that, and you can either make a character in the vein of the historical ideal of a knight, or you can make a character that responds to that and maybe does something different. Mm-hmm. And I love Geoffrey de Charny. I love his book. I think it's a fantastic read. And his motto, it's lived in my head rent-free since I first read it about 4 years ago.
Sorry, what book is this?
A Knight's Own Book of Chivalry. Okay. Published, I want to say, in the 1340s. I read the translation by Elspeth Kennedy off of Amazon. And his motto is, qui plus fait mieux vaut. Who does most is worth most. And I asked the kids, like, that's the motto of one of history's greatest knights. What do you all think about it? And I am so proud of every single one of them, because they all said, I don't know. I feel like if you can't do, are you worth less? They were like, is it ableist to follow that, to believe in that? And I'm like, oh my god, you all have such a nuanced understanding. You're all so goddamn smart. This is awesome. And we got to sit down and chat about that. And for my own part, my own read of it is that it can be an ableist statement, but I don't think it has to be.
No.
I think it can be, the way that I interpret it is, who does most is worth most means it do as much as you are able to.
Yeah.
For me, I've had days where I've been so depressed that I, like, just getting out of bed, washing my face, and eating a handful of shredded cheese out of a bag is taking care of myself. And if that's all I got, I've done the most, I am worth the most, as much as I can be that day. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a framework for like establishing like his hierarchy of actions, but I didn't kind of dive into that. And I got a very beautiful postcard from one of the mothers of those kids about a week and a half later, saying that they thought it was really neat the way that I just talked about mental health in this framework and how it doesn't have to be, depression doesn't have to be this big, scary, world-ending, life-changing thing. It can just be, just be some such that you got to deal with every now and then.
We are 40 minutes in.
Holy cats.
Yeah, 45 minutes in. And okay. So, folks at home, for some reason, Instagram has decided to disable a few features. So I can't see that there's no chat, there's no comments on my end. I don't know if you got it on your end, Aaron, or if anyone else.
I can see like a lot, one line at a time. And boy, howdy, is it tedious to try to parse through it.
Oh, I can't see anything. It's not showing me anything. So with that in mind, folks at home, if you want to throw in a question for our guest, Aaron, please do so via the question box. I know that it's that little button at the bottom of your phone. It looks like a speech bubble with a question mark in it. I know that there isn't a lot of room in that in that box. Yeah. But unfortunately, it's the only thing I, at my end, can read. Instagram's being a bit sucky today. So if you want to ask a question, stick it in there. Try and keep it brief. And we'll read it out.
I can see one from X Old Steel. Wow, so you free spar with only gloves? I can, but only with people that I really trust, like people like from the Academy Duello. I'll do this, and I don't go at full speed either. Like I'll go at a slower clip. Do that with like the senior instructors that I know and don't think are maniacs. Probably not with like, my brand new students. Who else did anybody?
We've got a question here from Kimmy.
Oh yeah,
your old pal Kimmy. And they had Muse. What's your favorite Fury play for kids?
I love so very much. It depends on their age. The younger kids, anyone that's like younger than like 13, I love teaching them the Pommel Strike. I think it's great, especially because I get to read my favorite passage from Fiore, which is, this is another pommel strike, and if your opponent's face is uncovered, you can do it at once. You will make them spit four teeth out of it. I will make him spit four teeth out of his mouth. It has been done. In my heart of hearts, I want to believe that there's an undiscovered document of Fiore just keeping track of how many teeth he's made some dude spit out about that pommel strike each day. July 13th, 1382. Four teeth. Perfectly average. If they're a little bit older, I love showing the kick in the balls from the first master. It's so much fun. Everyone takes a look at that and they're like, oh, sword fighting was like this graceful and noble art. And I'm like, nah, like it's grimy. Everyone does it. I like talking about Giardino's pocket sand. I like that he has like a whole section on this. I like talking about Mancillino's kicking the balls is fun, which is countered by a pot, like smashing your buckler into this person's shin. Just such a filthy, messy way to do it. Oh, I love it so much.
I can't remember. Who is it? Someone does a sacrifice throw as well.
So, oh, I want to know about that.
It's sword and buckler. And what you do is, I can't remember who it is, but you throw your sword and buckler away. You grab the other person by their wrists and you plant your foot into their chest and throw yourself backwards. And
that's such a cool play. Oh, man. I remember Jess Finley showed me how to do that sacrifice throw.
Yeah.
I can't remember the source though. Oh yeah, that's okay. That's a cool one. I like that.
I'm gonna have to look that one up. It's a funny one. I want to talk about neurodiversity with you.
Yeah.
Neurodiversity in learning and sword play. Now it's like lots of people that I've interviewed in the past have really opened my eyes about folks on the autism spectrum, folks with ADHD, and what that's done for me personally as an instructor has really opened my eyes about learning styles and teaching methods. and how we all learn and how everyone is different. So I just wanted to pick your brains about neurodiversity, particularly within HEMA.
Yeah.
We seem to be a very neurodiverse community.
Yeah. It's I've never seen so many folks on the autism spectrum in a room whenever I'm teaching a lesson. It's great. I've never really stuck. I think my own the broad strokes for me has always been, I really try. It's been the best to me to think about how flexible I can be with my lesson plans and my teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that with a lot of my very neurodiverse students, I've had to really meet them where they're at in any given. Oh, you seem to have frozen. Oh, there you are.
That's right. You glitched as well.
Just the willingness to kind of meet my students where they're at has been very, very good for me. Something else that I've found, I think it was one of the first archery lessons that I'd led on my own. And I was teaching a group of Montessori kids. And I remember the teacher came in and said, this is Jake. Jake's on the spectrum. He super does not like being touched. I don't know how you're going to teach this lesson. And I was like, okay, well, let me talk to him for a couple minutes. And I just he was young. I think he was like 7 or 8. I kind of got down to his level and said, hey, hi, how are you doing? My name's Aaron. I'm the teacher. It's nice to meet you. So this is the way the lesson's going to go. We're going to talk about archery, how to pull a bow. It's a little harder than most folks think it is. You can't just yank on the string. Usually there's ways we want to structure our body. I tell people about how to stand and how to align their arms and chests and backs so that they can do this. Usually the way I'll do that is I'll show them the shape, and if they can't make it the exact way that I do, I'll give them little adjustments, kind of just like with my fingertips. And I understand you don't really want to be touched. I'm going to do my very best to just show you the shape and tell you what to do. Does mm-hmm. that work? And he said, yeah, that makes perfect sense. That super works for me. And you know what? I don't even think I'll super mind if you touch me like that and you ask me first. It's just, no one ever asks to touch me. They just kind of yank me around. I'm like, cool. I'm always going to ask you. And if you say no, that's fine. I'm not going to be cross. I'm not going to be bent out of shape about it. And we taught that, and we went through the lesson. And when it was his turn to shoot, he got up to the line, and I was like, "Okay, standing good. Okay, can you lift your elbow up? Can't lift it. Cool. I'm just gonna give it a little push. That okay?" And he's like, "Yeah." And I adjust him into shape, and he shot a whole really nice ends. And at the end of the lesson, the teachers were just looking at me bug eyed. They're like, "No one's ever touched him before. No one's ever done that." And I was like, "I just gave him agency in the exchange. This isn't." I don't think I've done anything like, I don't think I've made any real 8-dimensional plays here. And that's since become a real cornerstone of my teaching. I tell all of my new students that they have agency in their practice and that their agency is sacred.
Mm-hmm.
I think that does a lot to put my neurodiverse students at ease.
Yeah.
To work with a lot of students that teachers and parents will describe as hard cases in that way.
I like that. Just agency in itself, whether that's agency to decide when they get touched by someone and if they get touched.
Yeah.
Even agency to say, I don't want to do this, or even agency to just leave the room and go somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. Kim and I had a bunch of kids. Come through night camp, because I started. Kim was taught me a lot of what I know about teaching. Mm-hmm. She was one of the people that helped me out. God bless her. I love her to the moon and back.
I love that person. They're
She's so great. She rules. she would always tell kids like you don't gotta jump in if you don't want it. No one's gonna twist your arm, but you just gotta kind of stay within eyesight of us. You don't want to swing swords, you can just kind of chill out off to the side, read a book, hang out, just don't disrupt the lesson. And like plenty of kids have said, I don't want to do it. It's like, okay, just go chill out and relax. And eventually they look up and they're like, oh man, I'm bored. That looks rad. And then they get and then they come join in.
Yeah. I'm just checking the time here. So yeah, we've got about 5 minutes left.
If I could just expand on that with one last bit, that I even try to extend that into the structure of my lessons. I'm very fortunate in that I work with like small groups of homeschoolers. I don't really have to have a curriculum per se, so I can just kind of check in with the kids each week. A technique I got from some friends that are intimacy consultants is to just check in with mind, body, and heart. And it's like, how are your muscles doing today? Are we sore? Are we stiff? Or how are our heads doing? Are we like, kind of like clear eyed and ready to engage? Are we feeling calm and balanced? Or are we kind of having a rough day?
Oh my God.
Those lessons let me structure my classes. Like I had a couple weeks ago, I talked to one of my groups and they said, we're tired. We're really tired today. We've had a long day in class. I don't feel ready to learn anything. I'm like, cool. We're going to play games then today.
Yeah.
Or this week I was, how are we doing today? We're hungry. Give us something to chew on. Cool. We're talking about tempo in depth today. But yeah, that's okay. I think flexibility, the advice I'd offer is to engineer as much flexibility as you're able into your lessons. And that will pay enormous dividends for neurodiverse folks.
Yeah, flexibility and agency. Because the thing shut me down. My final question for you, Aaron, is what tips do you have for people who are new to HEMA? Because the vast majority of folks who follow this account, I found, are new.
Yes.
So I want to give them something that they can use. I mean, my standard advice to folks is go on HEMAalliance.com, find your nearest club. But what other gems do you have to offer to people who are new?
As a shameless plug, DM me and I'll give you video lessons. If you're in Vancouver, get at me. I'll teach you. If you're willing to pay my travel, I'll go anywhere in the world and teach you. As resources go, you might there's lots of good stuff on YouTube that can teach you mechanics. I really like Ilkka Hartikainen from Marazzo.com. He does really, really cool stuff for just like very basic like learning guards, and his walking in the guards videos. Awesome. Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Duello TV is an incredible resource. Devin's world class. I've been blessed and I've been absolutely spoiled by having functionally nothing but world-class and curated world-class teachers for my whole swordplay career. As a perhaps more philosophical approach, I make everyone give themselves permission to suck the first couple lessons that they do. Say, okay, I want everyone to repeat the as an exercise at home, repeat the following. I'm allowed to make mistakes. I'm allowed to be bad at this. I am allowed to suck. Say it out loud. Say it every single time you do a lesson. It is important to not just say it after I tell people that, I'm like, you not only have my permission to be bad at this, but you more importantly have your permission to be bad at this. And that is exceptionally useful.
Yeah.
Another tip that I got, because I spent a lot of time really reconnect to the joy and like the piece of my own fighting psychology, is if you find yourself getting bent out of shape about what's happening, wiggle your butt cheeks.
Yes.
Wiggle them until you start to giggle, and then go do it again. It'll take you out of like whatever sour headspace you're in, and like plug you back in really nice.
I wiggle my toes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I shake my butt until I start to giggle, and then I go.
I'm gonna try that.
It's good. It's a free. That one's on the house. Take it and spread it everywhere. For maybe slightly more high level practitioners, a fantastic piece of advice that I got. I suppose this isn't for anybody new. Yeah, find an instructor, even if it's the freebies that you can get online. Almost anything is better than nothing. Don't take yourself too seriously. Let yourself be bad at this. And for the longer term students that want to try to get back into that headspace, because it took me a long time to get there. I had to start thinking about how I frame my success in my practice, because I was getting really bent out of shape for a long time about not winning every fight. And Devin quite reasonably pointed out to me, if you go into every fight hoping that you're going to win, you're going to go fucking crazy. It's going to drive you bonkers.
Yeah.
Dad, instead of like, or if you, instead of that, think to yourself, okay, I'm going to make as perfect a quarter as I can. If I can do that 5 times, I get a point. I win this pass.
Yeah.
Or if I can just perceive tempo, mm-hmm. I win. Like, that's something that one of my other instructors made me do. He, like, when I was getting ready for my free scholar test, he deadass, like, pulled me aside one minute and said, you're not allowed to hit anyone for the next 20 minutes. You're allowed to go until they get bored or until you lose. And I went, damn it, yeah, okay. and it was magical, because, like, I saw tempos lighting up in front of me when I stopped chasing hits really, really hard. And that was great. And one last piece of advice for the new folks. You probably won't hit your instructors, but if you can make them step backwards, you've won.
Yes.
If you can give them no better choice than to step back, or if you can force them to do like a feint or like a high level play where they like do like a duplié Aaron or a reach around your sword. If you force them to do anything but the basics, you have won. Nice job. Pat yourself on the back. It sucks to get hit, but if you can make them be cheeky, you're doing really good.
Yeah, I think perfectionism is a pandemic.
Yeah. Oh God, it's a plague. It's awful. It's
awful. You know, like saying when you're starting out, you're not. You can't be perfect starting out.
Yeah.
You can't. You know, you the only thing that you really, really need starting out is diligence.
Yeah.
You just got to show up.
Yeah, just build it. Just build good habits. Yeah. You'll do fine. Yeah,
shut up and mess up a lot.
You probably don't have a duel to the death tomorrow. Just be cool. It's fine. If you do, get at me at Golden Triangle Fencing. I'll give you great lessons. Money up front, though.
Oh, you'll be writing a treatise before you know it.
Yeah, I know.
So,
more on that later. Like my own neurodiversity, I engage with the logic of the art a lot more than like rote plays.
Yeah.
That's we get like I've got another 2 hours of talk in me if it
lasts,
but
tell.
It sadly does not.
We've only got through half of my questions, but unfortunately we are out of time. So that just leaves me to say, Aaron LaMontagne, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Seem, extremely graciously for having me. This is I'm an incredibly huge fan of your work. I reached out to Intimacy Professionals after that podcast you did on gatekeeping and HEMA like a couple months ago. You have changed my teaching for the better.
Likewise. Thank you. Thank you for all your insight.
Thank you so much.
And I'll probably see you on the show again sometime. Thank you.
I sincerely hope so. Thank you again. Have a nice day and happy Halloween and blessed Halloween for the Wiccans in the audience.
Take care.
Thank you. You too. Bye bye.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To show your appreciation, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform, or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/swordwomen. Go to @swordwomen on Instagram to see upcoming interviews, or visit buythesword.net to learn about our events, or visit our Facebook page, By the Sword.